Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Plotkin coming at you live from my house. In attendance are my sons, Mendel and Amram. May they be well. Today is Isru Chag. It's also Columbus Day. Maybe that's the reason why there's no school. Mostly Isru Chag. We just had a chance to say Tehillim for Israel, for the state of Israel and the Jewish people who live in Israel. The horrific attack on Shabbos Shmini Atzeres. Haven't seen that since Nazi Germany. Flat out, that's the reality of it. Arabs have they just morphed into Nazis, and they do Nazi tactics, and they celebrate. And they're never going to stop celebrating, because that's the infected mind of the Arab Muslim is toxic. Islamo-fascism is toxic, and it's a cancer. And it's metastasized into their brains, and they cannot stop it. They cannot stop the hatred. They cannot stop their anger and their fury at the idea that there's a state of Israel, that in Palestine, it is a complete affront and insult to the Muslim mind that Jewish people should be in charge of anything, let alone their own independent sovereign state in what used to be Muslim-controlled land. It is a complete affront to their sensitivities, their minds. It's a scandal to their religion. They can't make any sense out of it. How does Allah allow Jews who don't go along with Allah and Muhammad? How does Yimach Shemo V'Zichra, how does Allah, their God, how does he allowing the Jewish people to come back to Israel and establish an independent state and tell Muslims what to do and turn Muslims into second-class citizens? Only Jews can be second-class citizens. And that's what they were ever since the beginning of Islam. Either they were killed for not converting, or in some places they were allowed to remain Jews, but they had to pay a dhimmi tax. They had to pay a second-class citizen tax. And now suddenly they are no longer in charge of Palestine, and the ancient Jewish homeland has been returned to the Jewish people by the world, by the United Nations, and the Jews all over the world have returned to the land of Israel, and this offends the Muslim mind to no end. And there can be no peace with this. And therefore they have to kill every Jew, because every Jew is offensive. If he's living in Israel, then he is part of the problem. And they see themselves as the solution. They've got to kill every Jew, and then there'll be peace in the Middle East. If every Jew is dead, the state of Israel is destroyed, then we can finally have some peace in the area. Obviously, that is very pragmatic politics. What's going on cosmically up in heaven between the Sar Shel Yishmael and the Sar Shel Yisrael, which is God, I don't have much information on. I do know that at the end of days, things are going to get very bad. Nobody really saw Gullus Yishmael coming up. It's always been Gullus Edom. And now suddenly, because of Islamo-fascist terrorism, now suddenly the world, the Jewish world, has perked up to the idea that there's now a Gullus Yishmael. But growing up, I never heard of it, because the Arabs were... Because when I was born, the state of Israel was already in existence, and the Arabs got hammered sometime later, and in the Six-Day War, and they were very humbled for a while. Then came 73. I get that, the Yom Kippur War, and they tried to get save some face and attack Israel again. Again, they lost, and that was again embarrassing to them. So, in order to save face, very important for Arab Muslims to save face, to not be embarrassed in the sight of a Jew. They therefore attack and attack, and every time they do something that's barbaric, they feel that is wonderful for their side, and it makes us embarrassed and humiliates us, and therefore that's a good thing in their eyes. Well, we're going to respond the only way that we can to tshuva, tefillah, and tzedakah. We just had a Torah study session in Gulf Manor Synagogue, which is, as far as I'm concerned, the Community Synagogue of Cincinnati. Say what you will. I know that I'm very biased. I've been a member of Gulf Manor Synagogue ever since we moved here in 07, but it certainly is the locus for things like this. So we gathered together many children and their fathers. They studied Torah together for 30 minutes or so, and then came a 15-minute presentation on the grim situation in Israel, and we said Tehillim. So that's what we can do. Tshuva, tefillah, and tzedakah, but we got to really do it. Tshuva, we got to return to God. Tefillah, we got to pray hard and behave ourselves when we do it. Tzedakah, very important. Giving money to Israeli charities to help support Jewish people in need in Israel. Israelis are in desperate need of all kinds of help, political help, financial help, emotional help, for sure, food help. And so there are many good charities to give to, among them Leket, Meir Panim, Yad Sara, Magen David Adom, One Family Fund, Israel Guide Dog Center, Efrat, so that Jewish children can be born to replace those who have been lost, Nebuch. Imagine 700 Jews killed and in the thousands injured in one day. Such a thing has not been seen in Israel since the Yom Kippur War. And it's not, I'm not even sure of that. I don't even know if the Yom Kippur War saw that many casualties. I just don't know that. But somebody said that we haven't seen this many Jews die in one day since the Holocaust of the 40s, obviously. And so that was 80 years ago. Men was asking a question. Please speak up.
Father, do you think now would be a good opportunity for Israel to destroy the Dome of the Rock?
No. I don't think that destroying the Dome of the Rock is a good idea. No, this is not for that. Israel's got to destroy Hamas and Islamic Jihad. And it doesn't really want to invite an invasion by Egypt, which will feel obligated to do it. And Saudi Arabia and Syria and Jordan and Iran and Iraq, they'll all start invading. Whether they're capable of invading or not, it won't matter anymore. They'll have to do it in order to save face. Saving face is very important, as I said a moment ago, to Muslims. They very much care about how they are perceived by the world. And if Jews destroy the Dome of the Rock, which has been there for, frankly, a very long time, and it's one of the marvels of the religious world, whether you like Islam or not, and I'm not a fan of Islam by any means. I think it's a toxic cancer on the world. It's a scourge. However, Dome of the Rock is a beautiful building, and many people go there as tourists, and many people pray there. And to destroy it would invite absolute pandemonium and chaos in Israel, even more than now. So if you think this is bad, imagine Israel having to fend off armies of all sorts from every direction imaginable and missiles coming in from Iran, which is exactly what would happen. We don't need that. We just have to focus in on destroying Hamas and Islamic Jihad politically and militarily. And then cosmically and religiously, Jewish people have to improve ourselves. I know I've got to improve myself. You've got to improve yourself. Everybody's got to improve himself. As the Torah says, we have to humble our hearts and get back to God. Listening to Jason Roden, who is commenting on Dr. Michael Brown, as Jason does his wonderful counter-missionary work, he was quoting Psukim. One of them is, we have to humble our hearts, and then Hashem forgives. So we got to do that. Got to study God's Torah, which he gave us. Doesn't want us to be ignorant of it. Wants us to be knowledgeable of it. It's God's word, after all. What could be more precious than that? So we have to study that. Get to know it, be comfortable in it, and swim in it, and do charitable works. That's everything from giving money to giving time to giving blood. If you can't give blood in Israel, then give blood over here and let it redound to the schus of the Jewish people who live in the state of Israel. May they all be well. May the state of Israel be safe and secure. Destroy its enemies. So they got to do what they got to do politically and militarily. And we Jews worldwide have to do what we got to do religiously and spiritually so that cosmically we change things. And with that, we will do our book club class. We start on page 171. Smack in the middle of Rabbi Soloveitchik in his book, The Return to Zion, Addresses on Religious Zionism and American Orthodoxy. This is part two. This is a speech that he titled Zionism and the Mizrahi from the Perspective of a Ravenhead and a Dovehead, delivered in April 1954. So it was 70 years ago that he gave the speech, roughly 70 years ago. And he talks about how he's both a raven and a dove. He's a raven in that he is critical in his thinking. He's rational. He thinks deeply. He thinks in a sane, intelligent manner. He takes his time and he analyzes things. And he approaches things from a cool, calm, almost academic approach to matters of importance. On the other hand, he's a dove. He's loving. He's caring. He's compassionate. He loves the Jewish people. He loves God. He loves the land of Israel and the political state of Israel, and he wants it to flourish. And so he's got this conflict going on in his mind between being, you know, rational, critical, thinking, and at the same time loving and compassionate towards the state of Israel. It's not always correct in what it does, but he loves it just the same. Now, and you need to hear what he said in the very first part of this class, rather, part one of this chapter, of this lecture, Zionism and the Mizrahi, from the Ravenhead and the Dovehead perspective. We did about 15 pages last week. So I'll turn your attention to the lecture that we gave on October 2nd of this year. It was only a week ago. First day of Chol HaMoed Sukkos, we gave a class. We're now going to finish this chapter. However long it takes, it'll take. Not that very long. I think it'll be about 10 pages or so. And when we're done, we're done. And we'll call it a day. Page 171, at the very top. Part 2 begins now. Rabotai, at the beginning of this talk, I acknowledged that my dove head identifies with the Mizrahi, even though it seems to many that I stand outside the camp. Let me clarify why I feel so connected to the Mizrahi. First, Rabotai, simply as an expression of gratitude, of historical appreciation. See Jeremiah chapter 2. I accounted to your favor the devotion of your youth. Ahavat kelulotayach, your love as a bride. Lechtechacharai bamidbar, beretz lo zerua. Hey, you followed me in the wilderness, in a land not yet sown. Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 2. One of the most beautiful psukim in all the Bible. The Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi built the land of Israel at a time when other religious groups still kept the building of the land at arm's length. It's true. Other religious groups did not get involved in the building of the land. They criticized it. Or at best, they just said, oh, that's very nice. I mean, it's nice to develop Israel, the land of Israel, but they weren't there on the ground doing it. The Mizrahi and the Apollo Mizrahi were actually doing it. Yes, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, you distinguished. Providence selected them, meaning the Mizrahi, as partners in the great miracle of the redemption of the land, which is being realized now before our very eyes. How painful I'm reading these words when we're in the wake of just the most atrocious attack on Jews in the land of Israel, at least since the Yom Kippur War in 73. And in terms of pure barbarism, in terms of pure barbaric behavior, this easily eclipses the Yom Kippur War, because the Yom Kippur War was fought by soldiers. I mean, you got to give credit to the Egyptian soldiers. I mean, they're not barbarians. They were in uniform, and they attacked Israel, and Israel fought back in uniform, and armies went at it, and they fought a war. But over here, this is by a bunch of terrorists who target civilians, killing civilians in a music concert, killing children, killing people in their homes, killing them on the streets. That's not a war. I mean, that's not a normal war. That's not an army invading. That's a bunch of terrorists creating panic and terror. Israel's got to respond, not in kind, but a thousandfold, and destroy Hamas. And unfortunately, it's going to have to remilitarize the area Israeli style and probably take it back so that Israel will be in charge of Hamas, of Gaza Strip, because you can no longer trust the Arabs to be in charge of the Gaza Strip. They'll just be taken over by the biggest nasty bullies. That's how bullies operate. They throw their opponents off the top of buildings, and they cow everybody else into submission. They pay off terrorist martyrs, and that's what they do. And everybody falls in line, because who wants to get killed? Everyone wants to live. But like Clay and Buck said on their radio show just now, they're a death cult, and they believe in killing. They kill their enemies, for sure, in the most barbaric fashion. And he forgot to say they also kill their own. They killed fellow Muslims.
Why?
Because that's how they are. They want to wipe out the opposition. So they wiped, they were throwing Palestinian Authority officials off buildings, and they took over the politics of the Gaza Strip. If they could, they would destroy, they would fight Sunni Shia Muslims from Iran. And of course they do whatever they can to kill Jews. There are probably no Christians in the Gaza Strip because they hate anything but Islam, and Islam according to them. So they've got to get wiped out because they are Nazis. You can't live in peace with Nazis because Nazis want to kill you. So anytime somebody rises up to kill you, they take, as far as I'm concerned, they're a Malik, they take on the form of Nazis, and you have to destroy Nazis. And you have to destroy Islamo-fascist terrorists. Otherwise, there's no peace. There is no peace. Everything was going along for years and years, and suddenly this attack. Now, of course, there were small attacks up until now, but nothing on this scale. So what provoked them? Was it the fact that Israel is not allowing them in to get construction jobs or other jobs in the trades? They can't flush toilets and plunge toilets. Is that what is annoying Hamas? No. Hamas has a charter to wipe out Israel. That's the charter. That's their constitution. And they look to Iran for funding because Iran has the same exact goal, wipe out Israel. So Hamas is not looking to get more of its citizens into Israel to work in the trades. As we said earlier today, Hamas is out to destroy the state of Israel, however it can do that. Now, it's not equipped to do it. It can't do it, and so it's frustrating to Hamas, but it does whatever it can. It kills 700 Jews. It'll injure 2,000 others. It'll take 100 hostage, and it'll try to barter Arab terrorists out of the jails. That's what they'll do. They can't destroy the state. It's too strong, but they'll do what they can. All right, Nebuch, let's hope and pray that everything will improve over there. Let's do what we can over here. Providence, again, Providence, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, meaning the Almighty God, selected the Mizrahi and the Polo Mizrahi as partners in the great miracle of the redemption of the land of Israel, which is being realized now before our very eyes. Again, he says this in 1954. I say this not so much with joy as with pain, because I would have preferred that all religious groups would have contributed to the work in which the God of Israel is interested, and seemingly highly interested. For how else can we explain the great miracle that is the state of Israel? Are you really going to tell me that the master of the universe is not building the land of Israel? Heaven forbid. Im Hashem lo yishmor ir, shav shakat shomer. Im Hashem lo yivne bayis, shav amlu bonav bo. Unless the Almighty God builds the house, the builders labor in vain on it. Psalm 127, verse 1. But who is actually participating in the building? The sinners. Are you really going to tell me that the Almighty God is not defending the land of Israel from all of its enemies? Who is protecting the land of Israel? The State Department? The Security Council? John Foster Dulles? Churchill? Eden? I wish that all Orthodox Jews, from the Neturi Karta to the Rabbinical Council of America, would grasp that the state of Israel, with all of its deficiencies, has accomplished something that no human fantasy could imagine in a historic way. It has sanctified God's name in the face of the Christian world. During the Hitler era, thousands of missionaries and plain theologians, including the great Karl Barth, would regularly claim that the words of the New Testament and the blood curse of that man Jesus were being fulfilled. The Jewish people were being obliterated because they had not accepted the Nazarene. Imagine that. The Jewish people, the claim was, the Jewish people was being obliterated because it had not accepted Jesus of Nazareth. Lectures to this effect could be heard on America's greatest university campuses. Speakers would read aloud chapters from the New Testament and compare them with the facts being reported in the newspapers. I myself had to debate with many Gentiles about this. I never knew this. I did not know, this is me, Plotzker speaking, I did not know the extent of this. I've read about, I read Conley's book, From Enemy to Friend, about the run-up to Second Vatican Council. I consider myself highly knowledgeable about Catholicism. And when I say that about myself, I'm not bragging. I'm letting you know that I know a lot about it. I've done a lot of reading on it, and I actually know about that religion. And I know its history. And I absolutely was not aware that on the university campuses, not every one of them was Catholic, obviously. Many of them were probably Protestant. And if I find it very striking that they were doing this on the greatest American university campuses. I find that remarkable in itself, that Protestants would have taken that position, that this is all a big punishment for not accepting Jesus. And then he's telling me that he himself had to debate with many Gentiles about this. Unless you read, you don't know anything. Jewish boys and girls are being influenced by such messaging. The youth began asking questions, big questions, historic questions. And within the specific climate of the American Jewish community, with its neurotic fear of anti-Semitism and its glorification of Christianity, in which Reformed clergymen played a large part, there loomed the danger of extinction. The Shiblach of Williamsburg and a proclamation by the Union of Orthodox Rabbis would have helped little in this connection. Jews were on the verge of losing their faith in eternal Israel, meaning the God of Israel. That's amazing. First of all, during the Second World War, there were no Shtiblach in Williamsburg. And if there were, there were not that many, because the Satmar Hasidim had not yet come over. I think that the waves of Satmar came over when the war was concluded. When the war was concluded, they had somehow survived. Thank God they did. And they were probably in DP camps, and they came to Brooklyn, New York. And the Satmar Rebbe eventually, he got himself to Israel through Rudolf Kastner, a Jew, Zionist, who saved his life. They don't want to talk about that. And then when the state is declared, he's such an anti-Zionist, he's got to leave Israel. I'm not sure if you're allowed to leave Israel because of political beliefs. After all, the Neturei Karta never left Israel. I mean, they stay there and they fight Israel. Well, Kol HaKavod Lahem, they didn't leave. You know, you'll pick up and leave because there's a state of Israel that just declared itself. I mean, is that one of the reasons you're allowed to leave Israel? Is that up there with Torah study and Parnassa and Shidduch? And now these days, medicine? If your kid needs help medically, you can leave, as that's what people do anyway. I don't know if it's officially allowed, but that's what people do. At all events, the Satmar Rebbe left the state of Israel and he moved to Brooklyn, New York. And there he created a very flourishing, highly successful Satmar Hasidus in Brooklyn, New York. No question about that. He was amazingly successful in what he did. And we're all happy that he did that because New York City benefited from that. But he left the land of Israel. And I don't understand what gave him the right to do that. I mean, people to his right, the Neturei Karta, they fight Israel tooth and nail, but they don't believe in leaving Israel. They'd never imagine leaving Israel. They live in Yerushalayim. Now, there aren't that many of them, and they're all psychopaths, but at least they stay in Israel.
Wait, what do they do?
They align themselves with the PLO and other and Iran. So right now, the Neturei Karta is probably celebrating that Jewish people were slaughtered in the streets. What? I mean, if I know the Neturei Karta, they're probably so happy that this is a dark day for the state of Israel, and it embarrassed the IDF, and soldiers were killed, and this puts a damage on the state of Israel. These people align themselves with the worst of the worst, with the scum of the earth. If they're not, I don't think that they're crying over spilled Jewish blood, because I think that they've shown themselves over the years. When you align yourself with Ahmadinejad of Iran, who keeps on saying, I want to destroy Israel, so he said 20 years ago, and the mullahs of Iran still say that today, So how could you suddenly change your spots? And now you're going to say that it's okay? You have to help out the state and fight against its enemies. No, these people align themselves with the Islamic Jihad, with the Hamas. They want the state of Israel destroyed. They think it's stopping the coming of Mashiach. And if you feel that the state of Israel is stopping the coming of Mashiach, you'll do everything in your power to destroy the state of Israel. And you will align yourself with its enemies. So you find the enemies of Israel and you align yourself with them. Iran, North Korea, I don't know, China, Syria, PLO, Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Yimach Shemam v'Zichram. These people are out to kill Jews. That's what they do. No, they feel that these Arabs are going to be able to distinguish between the real Jews and the fake Jews, and they're going to be allowed to live because they have aligned themselves historically with the Palestinians. Excuse me. So they have an expectation that when the Arabs take over the state of Israel, they'll be left alone because they're going to send a delegation in and say, we've always been on your side, and we'll prove it with photos and newspaper articles. And we've had a relationship with everybody who's hated the state of Israel ever since the beginning. And you know that because we've been meeting with you for years, et cetera, et cetera. That's how they're going to spin it. It's never going to happen like that because the state of Israel is not going to get destroyed. But it did take a slam on Shabbat Shmini Atzeres, that's for sure. At all events, Rabbi Soloveitchik is informing us that in America, during the Second World War, when the barbaric atrocities of the Nazis were being promulgated in the newspapers and discussed, they were being discussed on college campuses. And amazingly, speakers, preachers, priests, I don't know who was doing this. They were, I got to do some more research. This is fascinating. They were making speeches and saying, you see this? In the New Testament, it says, his blood be upon our heads. No, you see, it's coming true. Their blood curse they brought upon themselves. There you go. It's happening. The chickens are coming home to roost and they're getting killed. And this is God's punishment for the Jewish people for not accepting Jesus. That was their take. That was the Christian take, understanding their narrative of the Holocaust. Turns out that after the Holocaust, the Roman Catholic Church was so incredibly embarrassed by its inactivity and its inaction on behalf of Jewish people, that they didn't even know where to go. They don't really know what hole to run into and jump into to avoid the shame, the sheer embarrassment, the humiliation that they feel, that Pius XII knew what was going on. That just recently came out over the past 2 to 3 months. This is really, really new news, that Pius XII received telegrams on the ground from churchmen saying to him, they're rounding up Jews and killing them and incinerating them and cremating them and killing them and shooting them. And he knew that. Took no general actual action to prevent it. Now, what could, you might ask, what could the Pope have done? What could one man sitting in Rome do? And the answer is,
a lot.
He could have done more. He could have threatened excommunication to any Catholic, raised Catholic, born and raised Catholic, who was a member of the Nazi Party. The Bishop of Rome, sitting on the seat of St. Peter, could have said the following, I will excommunicate you, and you will have no longer any hope of communion with the Church and with God, and you will lose your portion in the next world. If you continue doing what you're doing, you must cease and desist immediately. You must stop your terrible actions toward the Jewish people. You must stop killing Jews because that's your belief system. You must replace it with the Catholicism of your youth. He never did that. He may have privately saved some Jews in Rome. That, of course, he must have done. I think that he's on record as having done that. Well, of course, we're grateful for that. 1,000 here, 1,000 there. No doubt. Some Roman Jewish people were indeed saved by the Pontiff Pius XII. That's true. But we're talking about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and then millions of Jews killed in Europe, in Poland, where the Nazi death camps were. Some were in Germany. Theresienstadt comes to mind. And maybe there was one or two in Russia, Babi Yar and some others. But you had Auschwitz in Treblinka and in Poland, at Dachau probably in Germany. These were incredible killing machines. These camps were just death mills. And he could have at least threatened that. He could have threatened with the most potent possible punishment imaginable for a Roman Catholic, to be in a state of grave sin, of mortal sin, that's how they call it, to be in a state of mortal sin, to be out of grace with the church, and to be in a state of non-communion with the church, where you're not given the wafer and the wine. And if you're an excommunicant, then you're outside the bounds of the church. And Catholics have always had the belief that they're the one true faith, that there's no other true faith out there, that Judaism and Islam don't rate, that they're wrong, and that only Catholicism is correct. So if you're a member of the one true faith, and there's no other faith, and you get excommunicated, oh boy, you got no hope of getting into heaven, because you're no longer in good graces with the church. That's how the argument runs, the modus ponens. If you continue killing Jews, I will excommunicate you. If I excommunicate you, you'll be out of communion with God and the church. If you're out of communion with the God and the church, you don't get into heaven. Therefore, if you continue killing Jews, you will not go to heaven. Okay, if A then B, if B then C, if C then D, A, therefore B, therefore C, therefore D. Right. I'm reading a logic book right now, so I'm improving my logic skills. It's true. It's true. I'm actually doing that. So here you go. Anyway, Reverend Soloveitchik is opening my eyes. I didn't know he was debating people, and he was probably forced into the debate. And it's just incredible. He's so right, though, when he says the climate of American Jewish community with its neurotic fear of anti-Semitism. How do I know that's true? You know why? Because you open up the American Israelite here in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I live. Every issue is all about anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism in Kansas. Anti-Semitism in California. Anti-Semitism in New York. Oh, anti-Semitism in Boston. Oh, no. Anti-Semitism in Germany. Watch out. Oh, there's anti-Semitic acts going on in Arab countries. Oh, boy. It's just all about anti-Semitism nonstop. Jews in America don't want to be hated. They want people to like them. As Reformed Jews, they actually do believe in kumbaya. Live and let live. If I'm a Reformed Jew, if I don't look identifiably Jewish, and I don't do identifiably Jewish things, I will be left alone. And everybody will love me because of that. Answer, no, they won't. They'll hate you all the more for mimicking them, perhaps. Be a Jew. I myself look pretty Americanized, but at least I do Jewish things. I send my kids to Jewish schools. I mean, I go into Jewish Orthodox synagogues. I pray there and I study Torah there. I mean, I identify with the Orthodox community. And on Shabbos, I have a much more identifiable Jewish look. That's my difference in Shabbos in the week. That's how I do it. I mean, right or wrong, that's how I do it. Mm-hmm. And back in the day in New York City, when I was a lawyer in New York, I wore my yarmulke into court. One guy came over and says, I have a question about Judaism. Can I ask you? Of course, go ahead.
What was the question?
Who remembers him? Something about the calendar, about a holiday. Who can remember the question? But he saw a lawyer with a yarmulke who came over, asked the question. I wore my yarmulke at Phillips Law Firm when I was working every single day. I came to work, I wore my yarmulke in the office. Identifiably Jewish. And whatever happens, happens. But these Reformed clergymen, they play a large part. He's so right. They dress up like churchmen, like the Protestant churches, bring in an organ, bring in a choir, have services on Sunday. Forget about the land of Israel. Forget about Zionism. They're going to become the best Americans possible. Not a formula for success, Reform. They're slowly, slowly disintegrating. Because when you want to be that Americanized, you might as well just go in full bore, marry a Christian, and raise the kids Christian. And that's exactly what they do. Jews were on the verge of losing their faith in eternal Israel during World War II. He continues, Do you know who, with a single declaration, negated all of their theological claims and arguments? The people assembled at that late Friday afternoon gathering at which Ben-Gurion presided and which declared Israel's independence. That was the people who, with a single declaration, negated all of their theological claims. And by the way, it also negates all the claims of Islam. The state of Israel single-handedly destroys Catholicism and Islam. It doesn't destroy Protestantism, because the Protestants read the Bible the way we do, like normal human beings with a brain in their heads and eyes in their heads. And they read the verses, you will be gathered, you will come back, you will come back, you will be gathered again, I will gather you again. Those verses come up again and again and again and again in Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and the 12 other prophets. And the Protestants read it because they read English or German or French or whatever they read, and they read the Bible. Catholics, being the hate-filled souls that they are, old-school Catholicism anyway, not Vatican II people, but old-school Catholics, had no idea that there were no belief system whatsoever in those prophecies of old. They would say, oh, that's about us. We're the new Israel. So God's talking to us. New, what does God say to you? He's going to ingather you to the land of Israel. He's going to bring you back. You yourselves don't believe in going back to Israel. Catholics don't believe that the land of Israel is of anything special. They really don't believe that. I mean, they call it the Holy Land. But they're perfectly happy to live all over the world without any expectation of going back and being ingathered to the land of Israel. Not a Catholic belief. It's a Jewish belief. Catholics believe they can be anywhere in the world. It's true, Jesus walked the land of Israel. That's true. They grant you that, and they grant that it's holy as a result. Fair enough. But they are happy, perfectly happy, to live in Rome, Athens, France, England, South America, anywhere, because they feel that as a universal church, they're suddenly Israel, and they're all over the world, and they do the sacrifices that Israel's got to do. One of the prophets talks about, from sun up to sundown, my name is great in the nations, and sacrifices are made. So they do masses, they do their mass magic show, and they feel that that is fulfilling that prophetic directive, and therefore they can live all over the world, and there's no reason for Catholics to go back to Israel. God is not talking like that to them. Meanwhile, Protestants read it, and they say, Israel remains Israel, the Jews are Israel, and we are grafted onto them through Jesus. This is their belief. And the Jews are going to come back to Israel, then Jesus will return, and everything's going to be hunky-dory. That's their belief. Catholics don't share that belief. They really, these two churches, these two approaches are very, very radically different. Radically different. You cannot ever equate them. So rabbis of the world, Orthodox ones, please watch out when you talk about Christians and their beliefs. You have to be so careful because you have 2 billion Catholics who see it one way, and I don't know, 500 million Protestants who see it another way. You can't mix and match. They're not the same thing. So Catholicism is destroyed by the state of Israel because they were always opposed to the Jews getting ingathered and establishing a state of their own and all that. Meanwhile, Protestants see in the prophetic prophecies of Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, they see right there that there is an expectation that God has, that he's going to bring back his children to the land of Israel and so on. So Protestants are very happy with the state of Israel. They support it mightily. The United States, the premier country in the world, predominantly Christian up until now, still is a little bit, but much more so in the past. But Congress, I mean, come on, giving billions of dollars every single year to the state of Israel? Are you kidding me? Of course. Political support, monetary support, military support, money, arms, politics. America has been the best friend of Israel, without a doubt. Ever. I mean, there is no other country on earth that even comes close to that. That gives Israel such political help in the United Nations and so much money and so much in the way of arms, and then Israel tinkers with it and does what it does for its own needs. But we send them planes and tanks and ships. I mean, whatever, what don't we send Israel? It's incredible. Protestants do that. As opposed to Catholics, when Herzl sat down with the Pope, Yimach Shemo, in 1903. Herzl said, yeah, we're thinking about going back to Israel, the Holy Land, and we'd like your blessing. Pope says, I'm not giving you my blessing. Totally opposed to that. Now, he says, listen, Mr. Herzl, if you Jews want to go back to Israel, there's nothing we're going to do to stop it, and we don't really have the power to actually prevent it, but just be aware that our priests will be there to convert you. Lohaya Villanivra, it didn't happen like that. The Jews came back, at first a trickle, and then a wave, and then an ocean of Jews from Europe. These were socialist Jews. They had nothing else going on in their heads other than socialism. These were Jews who were born into Jewish religious families, many of them. And they gave up the Torah and mitzvahs. But one mitzvah stuck with them. Building the land of Israel. There we'll establish a socialist utopia. And God says, I'll take these guys. These are Jews. I could use them. And he brings them into Israel. See him about Emabon Mesmecha, just like 3,000 years ago, so too now. Those who went back with Ezra and Nehemiah to build a second temple, they were not the leading scholars of the day. They were the low-life tramps of Israel. Intermarried, didn't know any Hebrew, didn't know one mitzvah from another, knew nothing. God says, I could use them. This way there's no Din Torah up in Shemaiah. Amazing thought. Same thing again. God says, I got to develop the land. Mashiach's on his way soon. I got to have a land where Jews are going to be there to greet him. It can't just be a backwater, some throwback like it was in 1850, 1860, when Mark Twain went there and said, what in the world is this place? Jerusalem's like nothing. There's nothing going on over here. This place is ridiculous. I thought it's like, you know, the great Jerusalem of old. No, nothing. Yeah, there's a church here, a church there, a mosque over here, and 10 Jews make a minion over there. Great. I mean, if he even said that. I mean, because he talked about how great the Jews were in a different piece of writing. You know, how the Jews doing it, how they're still around. And he was marveling at that. But in Yerushalayim, there wasn't very much to talk about. It just wasn't. I mean, there was the old Yeshuv, and what was that, 1,000 people? It wasn't a lot of people. And Yerushalayim was backwards. It was not an advanced city. Hashem says, enough of that. Let's get back to Soloveitchik. You've heard me pontificate enough about the pontiff. Let's go back in over here. Do you know who, with a single, I love saying this again. Do you know who, with a single declaration, negated all of their theological claims and arguments? The people assembled at that late Friday afternoon gathering, at which Ben-Gurion presided, and which declared Israel's independence. You know who else? The Jewish army. The girls and boys with their rifles and self-sacrifice. See Joshua chapter 5. Today I have rolled away from you the disgrace of Egypt. In fact, they put Christian theology on the defensive. It is an open secret that the opposition to the land of Israel on the part of the Vatican and enemies from certain quarters in America actually derives from a deep awareness that if the state of Israel remains a reality, part of Christian theology from that man down to the great scholastics is void. Take away the state of Israel, heaven forbid, and a wave of assimilation and apostasy, the likes of which we have never seen before, would inundate American Jewry. The Tituses of yesterday and today would once again bellow, where is their God, the rock in whom they sought refuge? See Deuteronomy 32. See Gittin 56b. And this cry would echo from one end of the earth to the other. The Mizrahi understood this then, continues to understand it now, and does not allow itself to be deterred or led astray. It deserves credit for this, and I feel that my place is with it. And I feel the same. I feel the same. I agree with Rabbi Soloveitchik. When you see the state of Israel, for what it really is cosmically, it is a complete shutdown of Catholicism and Islam. You can ask for nothing more. And let us go one step further. I wish to employ a logical, axiological method in order to explain what I mean. There is an old rule with which already Plato and Aristotle were familiar. A man first begins to appreciate the things he cherishes most in his life once he loses them. While he still has them, he does not sense their significance and what they mean to him. So it is with health, liberty, a home, a fatherland, and so on. When a person, heaven forbid, gets sick, is lost in a foreign country, or sent to jail, only then does he begin to recognize the importance of all the things he had previously taken for granted. Therefore, axiology, the study of the nature of value, recommends that a person imagine from time to time what it would be like to be without certain treasures that he possesses. If for a moment he shudders at the frightful thought of losing something precious, he will then thank the Creator of the world for all God has bestowed upon him and not bemoan the trifles. Imagine, God forbid, a person losing eyesight. How terrible that would be for a person who was sighted all his life and suddenly can't even walk 2 feet without bumping into a wall. Imagine losing the ability to hear somebody. You no longer hear a Devar Torah. You no longer hear a joke. You no longer feel part of the davening. You're constantly looking up to see if people are standing or sitting. Where are they holding? I have no idea where they're holding. I can't hear them. I'm davening. I can't hear the chazan. I can't hear a tune. Imagine davening like that. Davening in silence. You can daven like that, but it's not very satisfying. Imagine losing your mind. You suddenly lose your head. You lose your brain. You've stuffed it up with craziness. Either stupid, political beliefs like socialism and communism, and the other idioms, or you took drugs and alcohol and you doped your brain up and now you can't even think. Imagine going through life with a doped up brain, you can't even think anymore. Your brain is mush. Imagine that. Go to college, get doped up with idiot Marxism and communism and socialism. You walk out a zombie. You walk out hating the country that enabled you to go to college. You took loans out from the United States government, and now you learn to hate the government. You should be so ashamed of yourself. You shouldn't even be able to walk in the streets. But these zombies are proud of themselves. And then they riot and they tear down statues. Prison is a good place for them to get back their brains from the mush of the American university swamp. The cesspool, the toilets that American universities have become. God forbid you should send your children there. Chas v'shalom a million times to send your children to the woke cesspools and toilets of America. To send your kid to Harvard, Yale, and Stanford, and Princeton. God forbid a million times and more. Your kid will walk out. You won't even recognize him after 4 years. He'll be screaming communism on the streets. Even with respect to the master of the universe, Maimonides hints that in order to properly grasp how lucky one is to have faith and religion, a person should for a moment imagine that he has, God save us, lost the Creator of the world, and that he is wandering through a universe of blind natural law and absurd mechanics. That's what wokeism is. They don't believe in God. They can do anything they want. There's no God. Communism, Marxism, there's no God. They do whatever they want. You have to play fair if there's no God in heaven watching you. Destroy your enemies. Kill them. Imprison them. Prosecute them. Persecute them. Demonize them. That's what they do. That's what socialists and communists do every day. They demonize. They demonize their opponents. Then when that's not enough, if that doesn't work, if it never does, then they run off and they start persecuting us. And they start demonizing us and screaming and insulting half the country. MAGA extremists. MAGA extremists. That turd in the White House has the audacity to say that senile, demented old man who should have long ago resigned has the audacity to insult half the United States, the American people. He insults them every day. And his Marxist leader, Obama, tells him what to do and what to say. Writes his speeches, I'm sure. Imagine being so diabolical, so devilish, so in cahoots with Satan that you insult half the American people. We never heard such things. This was never came out of an American president, ever. I'm old enough to know that. Nobody would ever insult a fellow American, a tax-paying, Bible-reading, God-fearing American. You'd never say such a thing. Now they do. The cesspools of America are found all over this country. They're called college campuses. You would do well to keep your kids far away from them. I will. I will. Imagine having no God. That's what the Marxists have. There's no God for them. And therefore, they make up their own religion. and they make up their own set of rules, as crazy as they are, as hypocritical as they are, as inconsistent as they can be. That's Marxism today. You'll never hear them condemn atrocities done by Hamas. There's always a reason why they did what they did. And those poor, poor Palestinians, don't you know? Why they can just become Nazis. And they're doing it right now, Nazi-like stuff. But you'll never hear a Marxist ever condemn them.
And what do they call Jews and Nazis?
Because that's what they love to do. They love to demonize the Jew. And they put themselves up on a pedestal. No matter, Hamas can do anything in their eyes. Hamas can do no wrong. No matter what they do to a Jew, it's A-OK. Because you're attacking the West. Israel is associated with the Western world, with the United States. And in their minds, they're hooked up with Islamofascism. They see Israel and America as the great Satan. And not that Marxists believe in Satan, but they believe that Israel and America are the big, nasty capitalists. So they jump into bed, these Marxists, with the Islamofascists. And they're good bed partners. And they drop dead. Imagine losing the Almighty, and you wander through a universe of blind natural law and absurd mechanics. Then will he begin to understand what faith means. Sirchus Yisodei Torah, chapter 1. God revealed himself to me of old. Eternal love I conceived for you then, God says. Jeremiah 31, verse 3. I wish to apply this method of valuation, or as Maimonides puts it, suppose that to the Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi as well. Let us for a moment close our eyes and in our imaginations erase the Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi from the last 50 years of Jewish history. What will be the result? I do not know the land of Israel. We have here with us Minister Chaim Moshe Shapira. He surely gave you a report on the religious achievements in the land of Israel. But I can imagine how the land of Israel would now look if the Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi did not exist. The land of Israel would have no religious colonies, no religious kibbutzim, no religious pioneers, no religious school system, no ritual slaughterers in far-off locales, no mikvaot, no chief rabbinate. What would personal status questions look like in the land of Israel? Do not belittle the marriage and divorce law. One has to be a rabbi in America for many years and witness the chaos vis-a-vis marriage, divorce, and forbidden relationships in order to appreciate what this law means. You might tell me that the irreligious Jews in the land of Israel would have introduced it anyway, but I would reply that you are mistaken. One can only exert influence on the land of Israel through building, creativity, labor, and practical accomplishments in the plain sense of those words, without exegesis, not through wearying, unhelpful pronouncements. God said to Moses in Exodus 34, carve for yourself two tablets of stone. Moses, if you want Jews to follow you and to accept the tablets for all time, so they not break once again, then carve for yourself. Use them on your own. Hack the mountains. Plant vineyards and orchards. Pave roads. Build colonies. Go to the Negev. Protect the Judean hills. Stand with your rifle and guard the land. Then, quote, I will inscribe upon the tablets the words that were on the first tablets, which you shattered. I will chisel the Aseret HaDibros on the stones that you have carved. Without the carve for yourself, the Jewish people would not have received the completed tablets. Even if the giver were joined by the Union of Orthodox Rabbis, the Rabbinical Council of America, and the preacher Rabbi Soloveitchik. And let us say it openly. The carve for yourself was carried out by the Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi. As a result, there is a chance that their tablets will not break. But why should I speak about the land of Israel? I would do better to talk about America, for the roads of America are as familiar to me as are the roads of Nehardai, see Gemara Brachos 58b. If today there are religious laymen in America, Jews who support Torah and donate to yeshivas, it is largely thanks to the Mizrahi. The Mizrahi was the first to organize and consolidate the handful of religious laymen who laid the foundations of Jewish orthodoxy here, who built yeshivot, maintained Orthodox synagogues, and involved themselves in every sacred task. Do not forget that the founder of the Mizrahi in America, Rabbi Meir Bar-Ilan, Rabbi Berlin of blessed memory, was also the president of the Rabbi Isaac Elkanah Theological Seminary of Yeshiva University. And I know dozens of other Mizrahi leaders whose achievements on behalf of all yeshiva, and especially the so-called extreme institutions, were enormous. He's so right. He is so right. The Irving Bunims, who helped build up Lakewood, was he not part of the Mizrahi? And all the other Balabatim, were they all Lakewood products? Had they learned in Kletsk? Were they coming out of Kelm? Are you kidding? Are you crazy? Of course not. At best, they went to Yeshiva University, and most did not even do that. But they were Balabatim who were associated with the Mizrahi movement. And they were helpful towards building up even the right-wing yeshiva system. Don't believe it? Believe it. I live in Cincinnati now, from New York City. The Cincinnati Hebrew Day School was not put up 80 years ago by Lakewood people, but by Eliezer Silver. That's true. He was a driving force. He was, of course, a Talmud Chacham of first rate, but he had to approach Balabatim, who had to get behind him. One man can't build a school. You need many, many people dedicated to the idea with big, big, deep pockets. He found them. Then he had to talk to all the Balabatim to send their kids there. They did it. So that now the CHDS has been converted into a Lakewood Cheder 80 years later. I don't know what to really make of it. It's no longer the day school that it was for years when we first came here. They had Benot Sheirut. Now that's a thing of the past. God forbid they should even talk about that. God forbid they should even talk about the state of Israel. I'm not a fan. But at least the school gives a good education in Torah study. But you'll never hear a word of modern Israeli Hebrew. The kids have no clue about what's going on in Israel. They don't even know that there's such a thing as a state of Israel, because nobody ever mentions that phrase, state of Israel. They know that there's an Eretz Yisrael, and sometimes terrible things happen in Eretz Yisrael. So when all they associate the land of Israel is with atrocities and terror, because that's when they're gathered together to pray for Eretz Yisrael. Otherwise, they know nothing about the modern-day state of Israel, the joys, the beauty of the country, the beauty of the people, the sheer beauty of the land. They know nothing about the wineries in the north and the Negev in the south. They know nothing about Tzfat and Tveria. They know nothing about Yerushalayim and what's going on. They know nothing about Meir Shearim and Geula and Mattersdorf and Unsdorf and Har Nof and the Ramot. And they know nothing about nothing. And I mean that. Yes, Mendel, go. You go there.
Yeah, in the talk of high school, though, this Coco gives a Hebrew, a modern Israeli Hebrew.
Good.
And then also, one of the rabbis let it slip, state of Israel.
Right. Okay, Baruch Hashem, once in a while, they let it slip. The girls who go to the Atara High School, I spoke to the Hebrew teacher. She acknowledged 8 years, they know nothing. They can't say a word. They don't even know how to go to the bathroom. Where's the bathroom? I mean, it's pretty basic stuff. Okay, that's a basic request. So where is the bathroom? Okay, when you say Eifel or Beis Akise, that's not speaking modern Israeli Hebrew, obviously, and you get laughed out because you're speaking Mishnaic Hebrew. You're speaking Hebrew of 2,000 years ago. Start asking Eifel or Shirutim, and then we're getting somewhere. At all events, we continue. Rabbi Soloveitchik, when I came to America, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis was inextricably connected with the Mizrahi, and I can let you in on a secret. The Mizrahi was no more from then than it is today. The Mizrahi has also been very consistent, and I hope that it will maintain its position into the future as well, with respect to the conservative and liberal Jewish sectors. You will not find too many non-Orthodox clergymen in the ranks of the Mizrahi. It could have had many, but it decided to be consistent, which posed a major challenge, and if such feats render it deserving of excommunication, as some zealots have asserted, then I'm ready to take off my shoes, sit myself down on the ground and cry out, stay away, friends. Wow. Not only can I not imagine a religious Jewry in the land of Israel and in America without the Mizrahi and a Polo Mizrahi from a historical perspective, but furthermore, it is unthinkable from the standpoint of the immediate present and the far future as well. My membership in the Mizrahi stems from an ideological conviction, from a deep inner feeling. It seems to me that the Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi hold the answer to the greatest question upon which Judaism must now rule. And I must state openly that this issue cannot be left to stand. There can be no teiku in this. We can't allow ourselves to compile a pamphlet of uncertainties about this problem. The ruling must come forthwith and directly, right or left. The question is a simple one. How can a Jew, living in the midst of a modern, technologically advanced, scientifically transfixed world, which moves at an extraordinarily fast pace, lead a fully Jewish life based on the halacha and mitzvos, and still be able to participate in all branches of human endeavor? And this question relates not only to the land of Israel, but also to our entire way of life in the diaspora at large, and on the American continent in particular. He's so true. Now, of course, the Haredim in Israel have an answer. We're not going to be part of it. We're going to just alert. We could have done that 1,000 years ago, 500 years ago, 100 years ago we were doing it, and we're doing it right now. We're not dependent upon technology. We don't even need a state of Israel. We could be just fine without it. If the Arabs just take over and let us be and just sit and learn, we'd be fine. We don't need a technologically advanced state. That's what they would say. And we'll be supported by Jews all over the world. And we'll get a chalukah. We'll get a portion. The Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi have given a positive answer. The answer does not consist of a speculative philosophy or abstract theories. No, the answer can be expressed in one word. Faith. We believe with perfect faith that the Torah of Israel is large enough in its length, breadth, and depth, perhaps also in accordance with modern mathematics, which now operates within multidimensional space, in other mysterious dimensions as well, to answer not only questions about lungs, mikvot, and prayer, but also to respond to the most complicated problems of modern society in all areas of life. Its measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. See Job chapter 11. It is true that there exists another ruling on this question. And I wish to emphasize here, praiseworthy is he who can put it into practice. I am not, heaven forbid, criticizing this opinion. This position preaches separation, withdrawal from the world. It is consistent with the thinking of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai as he was exiting his cave the first time around, holding the Zohar in his hands, entirely immersed in supernal sanctity, completely intoxicated with heavenly beauty, with the song of the angelic Ophanim and holy beasts. He could not understand why people were plowing, sowing, and harvesting, while they had to pave roads, quarry stones, construct factories, found technological institutes, and master all the trades that the modern world cannot do without. And so he condemned those, quote, engaging in the needs of temporal life, end quote, incinerating them with his gaze. Gemara Shabbos 33b, anywhere Rabbi Shimon and his son Rabbi Elazar directed their eyes was immediately consumed. But providence did not agree even with him, and the heavenly voice reproved and reproached him. Did you emerge in order to destroy my world? Return to your cave! Well, only God can say that. I make a world, a beautiful world. Tov ma'od. Tov it was, Tov. Tov in the eyes of God, good in the eyes of God, creates a world, asks people to populate it. They do that. And you come out of your cave and you start destroying everything? Go back into your cave. That's where you belong. I created a world, not for you to destroy it. We are here to help God maintain it, improve it, make it happen, make it better and better, not to destroy it. Even Rav Shimon bar Yochai eventually changed his mind. Seeing an elderly man running with two bouquets of flowers during twilight on Friday evening, one corresponding to Zohar, remember Shabbos, and the other corresponding to Shomer, keep Shabbos, he remarked to his son, see how much Israel loves mitzvahs. Beautiful. One can hold the most beautiful flowers of modern life in one's hands and still fulfill both Zohar and Shomer. And if already at that time the heavenly voice decided the halacha of the Rav Shimon bar Yochai, that one can and must be involved in building the world and yet live a full Jewish life, then all the more so is that true today. In truth, Orthodoxy suffers from an anxiety complex attributable to the absence of a dynamic, fiery faith in the Torah of Israel, with its wonderful eternal youth, vitality, and magnificence. Apprehension over the idea that our God is old drives a small portion of the religious labor force in the land of Israel, like the Religious Worker Party, for example, to despair, which manifests in an absurd call for a new halakha. On the other hand, that same anxiety expresses itself in the opposite extreme, the abandonment by upstanding, observant, God-fearing Jews of historical reality, leaving everything entirely up to the so-called secularists. From all sides, we hear cries of, quote, we cannot attack that people. See Numbers 13. We cannot participate in this great political historical act of creation in the march of time. Why? Because it is stronger than we. The problems are too great, too complex, too new. To these, the Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi ideology responds, let us by all means go up, and we shall gain possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it. This is the Meraglim, and Kalev and Yoshua were the Mizrahi of their day. That's me saying it. Torah Jewry is strong enough to allow itself to wrestle with the most difficult issues and most explosive situations. It is true that there are many contradictions, many weighty questions, many bewildering problems. If a case is too baffling for you to decide, Moshe said in Deuteronomy 17, send it to somebody else. But we believe in the folk etymology of Teku, Tishbi, Yitaritz, Kushyot, Uvayot. Elijah the Tishbite will answer the difficulties and the questions. The Redeemer of Israel, who performed so many miracles in the recent past, will also help us resolve all the issues. See the Gemara Sota 44b, starting to flee leads to downfall. We are not running away. We are standing firm. I speak here as a partial party, someone with a vested interest. I raised my children according to this philosophy. I founded the Maimonides School in Boston with this philosophy, and I preach this philosophy to my pupils. I cannot abandon the philosophy of, let us by all means go up, and we shall gain possession of it, even if the Agudas Council of Torah Sages prohibits it. And I will tell you what sort of wonders this philosophy has achieved. When I first came to Boston, there were no Shabbat observers between the ages of 7 and 30, with the exception of 3 or 4 young people. Today, there are in Boston hundreds of young Shabbat observant boys and girls, boys who walk down the street and on the college campus wearing yarmulkes, boys and girls who are not ashamed to stand up and pray mincha in the Widener Library at Harvard. Last Friday, some boys did not go to school because a friend of theirs had passed away suddenly, and they had stayed up all night with their departed friend reciting Tehillim. On Friday, they carried the coffin. They buried the deceased in accordance with the halacha, and they told his relatives to rend their garments, something that many rabbis refrained from doing. These children, these young boys, do not come from Satmar, Meir Shearim, Skver, Kalna, or even Brisk. They come from assimilated Bostonian homes. Their parents do not know Yiddish. These children sacrifice for Judaism because they were imbued with the belief, let us by all means go up, and we shall gain possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it. If this philosophy is wrong, then Judaism in America has no future, and Meir Shearim too cannot endure. This philosophy is exemplified by the Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi, and so I stand with them. But there is another principle in the Mizrahi ideology that appeals to me. The kernel of this principle is mentioned by Chazal, but it is first formulated clearly and plainly by the author of the Tanya, of blessed memory. It is the principle of Ahava Tiv'it, natural love of God. According to this philosophy, every person, whether righteous or wicked, pure or impure, good or sinful, see Ecclesiastes chapter 9, each one pines for the creator of the world and wishes to do what is right. Sanctity, love of God, and drawing close to the mass of the universe are natural needs of man. A man cannot live without sanctity, just like he cannot survive without air or water. There is a natural drive to seek out the master of the universe. See Sefer HaTanya, Sefer Shel Benonim, chapters 18 and 19 and Pasim. According to Chabad, Judaism was not meant to implant in man a love for the creator of the world or a sense of yearning for a universe of complete eternal bliss. That sense of yearning is present within him, whether he is aware of it or not, from the 6 days of creation onward. What Judaism, the Halacha, teaches man is a method, a way to realize this desire, to turn the dream of sanctity into a healthy reality. For at times, a healthy instinct, a powerful impulse of man can mutate into a psychopathic drive if one does not know at the outset how to channel and cultivate it properly. See the Yaakov to Brachos, a thief standing at the entrance to a tunnel calls out to God. Even a robber breaking into a house in the middle of the night petitions God that he succeed in his undertaking. The sense of longing for sanctity and pining for the creator of the world is alive within him too. For it is an ahava tivit, a natural love. Even the worst evildoer cannot eliminate this love, this desire, not even the robber. Instead of transforming it into a positive, constructive force, however, he suppresses it. And like all drives that are suppressed, it expresses itself in a pathological form. And so, it is our opinion, and the fathers of Hasidism agree, that rebuke should never be too severe, too negative, too destructive. One may not push away anyone with both hands. See Sanhedrin 107b. One must reach out to the sinner, informing him that he is more Jew than he himself thinks, more rooted in sanctity than he himself imagines, that he is running away from himself by denying and suppressing his yearning for the master of the universe, his sense of, like a hind crying for water, my soul cries for you, O God. Kayol tarog alafike mayim, kain tarog nafshi elecha elokim. We Mizrahi members maintain that tshuva is open to everyone, that one may not exclude anyone from the Jewish people, so long as the spark of Ahavat Tivit continues to glow within him, even if it is buried under mounds of ash and sand. We Mizrahi members also believe that all the builders of the land, holding aside entirely their party affiliations, whether they belong to the Mapai or the Mapam, who sacrifice for the honor of the land and the nation, do so not on account of their Marxist convictions or because of rational historical considerations. Rather, their actions are driven by their Ahavat Tivit for the creator of the world. How could it be otherwise? Why do they fight so heroically in the War of Independence against the Arabs? Yimach Shemam, v'zichram. Why do they quarry the Judean hills and plant vineyards? Why do they sacrifice for the irrigation of the Negev and the defense of Israel's borders? Why could Elisha ben Avuya not separate himself from Rabbi Meir? Why did he tell Rabbi Meir, turn back, see Chagiga 15a? Why did he pass near the site of the Holy of Holies while riding on his horse? As reported in the Jerusalem Talmud, see Chagiga, chapter 2, halacha 1. Why would he wander through the marketplaces of Tiberia? You want to know why? Because Elisha ben Abuya could not help himself. The radicals in the land of Israel cannot escape themselves either. Yisrael Sava, Israel of old, chases after them. Their desire for sanctity, their Ahavat Tivit, drives them to devote themselves to the land of Israel and to the nation. It is true that they do not understand themselves, and they try to run away from themselves. That's why they fight Judaism with such zealousness and enmity. They wish to confound their inner voice. They seek to convince themselves that they have ripped it all out of themselves, but they will not succeed. We believe that, quote, Israel will ultimately repent at the end of their exile and will immediately be redeemed. See Rambam Hilchos Tshuva, chapter 7. And that we have the ability to hasten the redemption, not through statements, sermons, or articles in the press, but by living and conducting ourselves with dignity and respectability. If Orthodoxy lacks anything, and if it must pray for something, that thing is respect. And just as the entirety of the Jewish people prays on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and so, O God, grant your nation honor, so must we pray. And so, O God, grant those who fear you honor. I am not looking for people to like us, just to respect us. When one respects another, one is influenced by that person. We will not earn respect via demonstrations, not in Jerusalem, and certainly not in New York, not via curses and bans, not via party politics and insults, but via work, creativity, action, and faith, via carve for yourself, and via let us by all means go up. Let the Elisha ben Avuyas see your kibbutzim. Let them see your wonderful schools. Let them see your religious literature. Let them see your Shabbat, your family life, your acts of charity and loving kindness. Let them see sanctity in practice. Let them see for themselves how beautiful and magnificent Judaism is. When the maidens of Yerushalayim ask, how is your beloved better than another, O fairest of women, that you adjure us so, that you make us swear so? See Song of Songs, chapter 5. Let us be in a position to respond loud and clear. Ah, my beloved is clear-skinned and ruddy, preeminent among 10,000. See Song of Songs 5. And I can assure you that they will then fall in love with the beloved and proceed to ask, whither has your beloved gone, O fairest of women? Let us seek him with you. Song of Songs chapter 6. The party that represents these two principles, let us by all means go up, and we shall gain possession of it. And the other principle, my beloved is clear-skinned and ruddy, preeminent among the 10,000. That is the one to which I belong. You decide. Is it the Aguda or the Mizrahi with its philosophy of Ahavat Tivit? Let the congregation come and judge for itself. Have a good week.